So as Rachel just mentioned, I just come back from about 10 or 12 days in Japan, and I was attending a big Buddhist summit there whose expressed aim is to try and create some unity amongst all the different Buddhist traditions in our modern world. And they're very successful in getting some very high-powered leaders from all the major traditions. To actually to work together for the sake of harmony. And because of the success of that summit, and because of the importance of the topic, I thought I'd talk this evening about harmony and just how to create it in our worlds. Because as you know, just there's disharmony between the countries and governments and religions. There's disharmonies in society and disharmony in your office, and very often there's a lack of harmony in your own mind. And when there's a lack of harmony in one's own life, especially in one's inner life, it creates an enormous amount of stress and struggle. And it's not necessary we can sort of solve that. But certainly, when I first learned about Buddhism, especially when I became a monk, I found something fascinating in all of the rules which we have to live by as monks. One of the most important reasons why we had those rules for the sake of harmony, so we could live together, you know, without much argument or any argument in a monastic community. So the Buddha mentioned very clearly that when there's no harmony, there's no possibility of getting any deep meditation. Without peace outside, it's very hard to find peace inside. And it's important that we learn the techniques and strategies for developing that harmony and that peace. And many of you have relationships, partnerships, and unless you have harmony and peace in that relationship, it does create an enormous amount of suffering in your life. And even this morning, not so this morning, just before I came here this afternoon, I performed a marriage ceremony for a couple of our members who have been coming to this place for a long time, performing their ceremony at a monastery in Serpentine by the lake. And I mentioned a story which is one of the key stories from my book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, which I very rarely mention, about how we can. No, this story I don't mention. I mention the book very often, but the story which I'm about to mention, I think it's a long time since I mentioned it. And it concerns harmony and how we can work together when we really commit it, when we really think we have to. And it was a story of, well, maybe 22 or 23 years ago, when we were first starting our monastery. There was a young girl, she's much older now, who came to Perth with her husband. Her husband was a mining engineer. He had a contract for 2 or 3 years. They were young, newly married, without children. It was a nice adventure to come to Australia for a few years. And at that time, you could buy a house pretty cheaply, and you could sell it for a little bit more than you paid for, not like these days. And so they bought the house, and when the contract ended, they had to go back to Canada. So instead of getting an air ticket, they decided to sell their house, and with the money they got from their house, to buy a small yacht and sail back to Canada. They were young, it was an adventure. And the idea was that once they reached Vancouver, they could sell the yacht, get their mortgage back, or their deposit back, and then buy another house. A great way of travel. And it was also an adventure. You know, imagine sailing, you know, through the Pacific, through the islands, out to Canada. And of course, being sort of close friends, they wrote a letter to me when they arrived safely back in Toronto. But they said a very interesting event had happened while they were halfway on their journey. They had teamed up with another couple who were also going back to Canada. So there were two married couples. And in the middle of the voyage, so the engine broke down. And so the two men, the only ones who knew how to fix the engine, went into the compartment with the tools to try and fix the problem. Well, the two women, they had nothing else to do. They were just on the deck, just reading magazines, enjoying the sunshine. And of course, it's very difficult to fix things sometimes. And because the engine or the problem was difficult to discover, the two men started getting irritated. It was very close, very cramped, and very hot in that small compartment where the engine was. And the irritation soon became an argument. And the argument got worse and worse until they were shouting at each other. And the argument culminated in one of the men throwing down their wrench and swearing and saying, "Right, that's it, I'm leaving." And when you are angry, you do get crazy. And this was actually what happened. He was so mad and crazy with his anger, he actually went to his cabin, cleaned up, changed into some nice clothes, packed his bags, and appeared on deck in his best suit, carrying his suitcases. And they said it was the women laughing at him, which brought him to his senses. "What are they laughing at me for?" And then he looked around him, and there was ocean in all directions. There was nowhere to go. There he was on the boat. Saying, "Right, that's it, I'm leaving," was not an option. So he went red in the face. He went, turned around without speaking, went back into his cabin, changed back into his work clothes, went into the engine room and helped. And of course they fixed up that engine and they sailed back to Vancouver as friends. I like that story for two reasons. The first reason was it recognizes that sometimes there's no place to go. It's nice to say, "Right, that's it, I'm leaving," but we can't. Where can we go to? And number two is that when we accept that there's no place to escape, there's no place to run, then we can always fix up any problem. We can create harmony if we have the will to do so and the commitment to do so. When we understand that, it gives us hope for our world, because all the different religions and philosophies and cultures and nations in this world, there is no place to go if we have a war. In Japan, two of the places we visited to do some peace prayers was Nagasaki and Hiroshima, where they dropped atomic bombs. And you can still, as a monk, I'm very sensitive, you can still hear the screams of the people who got burnt to death and the cries of all those who had the worst, slower deaths from the radiation. When you go to places like that, it reminded me of another place I went to in April, which was just outside of Phnom Penh, one of the many killing fields, where when you walk on the earth, you are literally walking on the shattered bones of the many thousands who lost their lives in those killing fields. The earth has got white specks in it, and also there are shreds of clothing which are always coming up from underground. When the rains come, more come up. You get an incredibly sad feeling that why is it that human beings do this to other human beings? And with that feeling comes the commitment that you can't just sit down there and do nothing. You have to strive to do something, something really worthwhile and meaningful, so that we can create that harmony and mutual respect in our world, which makes such atrocities less likely in the future. Because there is no place to run. We have to learn how to live together. And the summit which we had in Japan was meant to show that, yeah, we're all Buddhists. Let's get the Buddhists working together. It does not matter so much what tradition you follow, And hopefully that everyone who comes into this centre is very happy to go to other Buddhist centres in Perth and don't think that we have the best centre and all those other Buddhists, they don't really know what Buddhism truly is. Sometimes we do have conceit like that. And one of the things which is important to understand, you know, as a Buddhist, when you have that conceit that, you know, your tradition or your path is the best, that is a sure sign you have a big ego. Well, the Buddha said there was actually three types of conceit, three types of pride. It's not just that I am better. It's also I am worse is another form of conceit. And even saying I am the same is a third form of conceit. The Buddha saw so much deeper than other people because we can't judge at all. Better, worse, these are two sides of the same coin. And even the same, we're all different. We're not the same. We don't have to be the same. But we can each receive the same amount of respect and give the same amount of value to others. So there's no ego and self there, being better or being worse. It's a very weird part of Western culture that we always want to sort of not to praise ourselves and even reject the praise of others, which means that in the West we actually develop from our many, many years a lack of self-esteem. And we make a mistake, or someone in our family makes a mistake, and we blame us. Even just this week, somebody rang up for counselling. Their child had gone into drugs in a very deep and bad way, and they were blaming themselves. Sometimes, as a parent, we blame ourselves for what our children get up to. And really, we can't really blame ourselves. That's been totally unfair. I gave the simile of a seed. Sometimes a gardener has a seed. Sometimes even the best gardeners can't make a beautiful tree out of a bad seed. And sometimes very stupid gardeners they don't know anything about gardening, but the seed is so strong it still produces a very beautiful plant. Why is that simile important? It's because it's not just the parents. It's what you're dealing with. And that child comes with karma from its past. Every one of you's had a child. Knows when that baby first comes out and you hold it in your arms, you know that's got history. That's not a new being. It's not a blank slate. That comes with a past. And you feel that sometimes it's a very old, wise being. Sometimes it's a being who comes into your life with problems. And sometimes mothers can feel that too. So never think that it's a blank slate which you can do whatever you like with. You have limitations as a parent, and I think you realize that. So we don't feel guilty about this. But why it is that people take on the pain of others and make it their own pain? Sometimes that's not helpful for anybody. So we sometimes do that to ourselves. We have this low self-esteem. We think we're worse than other people. Sometimes we think we're better than other people, or we're the same as other people. All of the three conceits. The Buddha said, don't even think like that. Don't judge or compare. The same, better, worse, it's all comparing, and it just cannot be done. It's amazing when you stop all that comparing business. We don't say all the different forms of Buddhism are the same. We don't say they're all equal. Not one is better than the other or worse than another. They're just different, and we can value each one. When you learn how to see value in things, then from value comes respect. And it's not that difficult to value the different parts of Buddhism, even the different religions in this world. A key story is I often hang out with people from other religions. I think it's good for me. Basically, I don't want to sort of feel like I'm in a cult, you know, where you only sort of hang out with Buddhists and talk with Buddhists and read Buddhist books and only go to Buddhist centres, because that's a dangerous thing. It's nice to have input from other areas in your life. You become very wise that way. And also, you can actually see the value in other things, and this is conducive to harmony in the world. So, you know, I like going to and to other little ceremonies. And this key story was when, I think the first time, I went to Christchurch Grammar School to give a talk. They wanted me to lead the assembly because there was a few Buddhists. I think a few Buddhists even from here were attending that school. So they asked me if I could give a talk there. And as we were going into the morning assembly, the principal turned around and told me, he said, because you're the speaker this morning, you'll be going in with me and with the chaplain. Now, Frank Sheehan is a good mate. And he said, what we usually do, there's a little, very simple Christian shrine there. We bow to that shrine because we're Christians, but we don't want to offend you. You're a Buddhist. You don't have to bow. And I took the opportunity to get aggressive. I turned round to him, the principal, and said, what do you mean I can't bow? I demand my right to bow. I was doing it to make a sort of a point, telling him that why, as a Buddhist, should I not bow down to a shrine like that? And he was confused. And I said, look, I don't agree with everything in your religion, but there's much in it which I can respect and value. And that which I respect and value is what I'm going to bow down to. And he understood what I meant. And I think just recently, was it in August or September, we had another visit from Christchurch Grammar School. They always bring their children at least once or twice a year. And this time the principal came himself, you know, to see what was going on. He had a wonderful time down there. So you can see what can happen, that when you show respect and value for something in another person's life, not everything, but to value that which is really worth respect, it brings this beautiful sense of peace and harmony, where we say we're not the same. We have our differences, but there's enough in you, in your path, in your being, which I can really respect, and I'm focusing on that. That means we can live together in peace and harmony. And what we have in common, if we keep focusing on that, that is what grows. This is an important part of Buddhist psychology, which is actually filtering down now into our Western type of psychology. We focus on differences and we split apart. When we focus on the negative, we become negative. You know, the two bad bricks in the wall. When you focus on the two bad bricks in the wall, you want to destroy everything. But instead of focusing on that which is bad, we can focus on the other part, that which we can respect in other faiths, in other parties, in other people. And that actually makes what we respect grow, grow, grow. And I think I did mention this in the previous talks. I was just, when I came back from Singapore, teaching at a mental health conference. And there, in Singapore, the modus operandi for the one hospital which deals with people with mental health problems was, do not focus on the disease, on the psychosis, on the depression, on the schizophrenia. Focus on the other part of that patient. Focus on the times when they're not having an episode of psychosis. And when I heard that, I thought, amazing, wonderful. You've got the message. Because when they found they were focusing on the times, those patients, they weren't exhibiting mental health problems. Focusing on the healthy side of them, if you want, the healthy side grew. And they found it was a much better way of treatment with far quicker and more long-lasting effects. You can see when we focus on the differences, on the faults, on the problems, those faults and problems actually grow. We're creating disharmony in our world, and especially with ourselves. So just as I treat people from other religions and faiths, or even people in my own religion who disagree with me, let's put that aside for a while. What do we actually disagree with? And let's value that, and that will really grow. And what do we have in common? As I move around, people of different faiths and different regions and different lands and cultures, what we have in common is this basic sort of, you know, love, of respect, of peace, of, you know, this real sense of freedom. And I don't mean freedom to do what you want. I gave a talk last night to the monks about what real freedom is. It's not the freedom to sort of go and buy that car, or to go and get that house, or that freedom to go and do what you want. That's not freedom at all. Because you see that what that really is, you're pulled by the nose by your desires. And you're pulled by the nose by, you know, your negativity sometimes. Someone can call you names. Even this morning, I just went to the chemist on the way up here, and a girl outside said, "What are you wearing those things for?" And I said, "Because I'm a Buddhist monk. Have you got anything underneath that?" It's good fun, isn't it? And I said, "Yes, I have, actually. I've got an underrobe." And she said, "Very good thing. Very good thing." But then, just as I got into the car, she put her hands up like this. And I thought, isn't that wonderful? Now, obviously, she was testing me out. And when I passed her test, she gave me respect. Now, little stories like that just show you that you could have got negative about that. But you don't. You respect the question, even though it's testing you. And if you respect the question, what actually grows and comes out of that encounter is a sense of, oh, you know, that lady, that little girl respects me and I respect her. So we have harmony rather than having a big argument and divisions in things. So that freedom means that you're not going to allow other people to upset you. You're free from these underlying tendencies of negativity or having to have. How many of you, when you're hungry, can go past a shop selling your favourite food and not buy it? I used to do that when I was a student. I had a friend who was a Christian, and that time I had lots of ego. Because he was a Christian, I was a Buddhist, we were always competing with each other. So when he said he was going to go on a fast, I had to go on a fast as well. And we had a competition, who would last longest. I won, shows how big my ego was. But to test myself, you know, I was born in England, and my favourite food was fish and chips. So I hadn't eaten for about 2 or 3 days, just water. And I would actually get on my bicycle and cycle backwards and forwards in front of the fish and chip shop just to test my willpower. But that was good because you could give it up. You could be free. Now, even recently, just combining what I've just said with, you know, the work we do trying to form friendships and harmony between the different religions. You may have read in the newspapers that the abbot of the Benedictine monastery in Eunorcia passed away recently. Again, he was another good friend. And such a good friend that I was invited to his funeral service. And that was actually just the day before I left for Frankfurt. And it was a mass at the church in Subiaco. But I wasn't just invited. I was also asked to say a few words as well. In a fully Catholic funeral, there wasn't any Muslims or Jews there, which I saw. Just the Buddhists. A couple of us went there. And actually to show the actual friendship we have. And how that was so respected that as a Buddhist monk, now, I was allowed to say a few words at a very senior Catholic's funeral in front of Archbishop Hickey. Now, and it was a full mass, which went on very, very long. If you think this goes on long here, you should go to the Catholic Church. It went on so long, I missed my lunch. It didn't finish till after 12. But it was worth it, because it was a wonderful thing to do and be part of. The best part of it was actually the friendship which you'd formed across the religions. And I mentioned this, and also mentioned this on this talk, which will be on the internet, because it can be done. And isn't it a wonderful thing that, you know, we can just have such friendship? So we can push aside all these causes for division and wars in the world. You know, they just executed the Bali bombers, and the newspapers were saying that everyone is really afraid there may be retaliation. Retaliation's not religion. I don't care what religion you have. That's never mentioned in any sort of wise, holy people's words. We don't retaliate. We forgive. We move on. Retaliation is to say, right, that's it, I'm leaving, I'm going to kill you. And of course, that means there's nowhere else to go. So real religion, real understanding is the importance of harmony, the vital importance of harmony above almost anything else. That's why, again, I said to the couple which I married this morning, sort of always remember, you know, what's the most important thing in your marriage. It's not being right. It's being together. And sometimes you can't have both. You can't be right and be together. As you all know, those of you who have had marriages or relationships. So when you have the priority right, it's being together is most important, not who's right and who's wrong. Then it means, oh, you can just keep giving in. Who cares who gives in? The man gives in, the wife gives in, we all give in. And if you understand that, then you understand how a relationship works. The togetherness is most important. And you understand just how in our modern societies, such togetherness, the harmony in society is so important, much more important than being right or being wrong. Because without that harmony, where is there to go? Where can there be any life, any prosperity? It's good whenever there's crises in the world, in the sense that people have to work together. I remember my parents telling me, especially my mother and my grandparents, who were in London during the Second World War. My father was up in Liverpool. And there, being bombed, not just, you know, 1/9/11, once in every 100 or 200 years, but being bombed every night, with huge bombs falling from the sky, night after night after night, during the what was called the Blitz of the Second World War. And hearing those stories, and hearing my mother and my grandparents saying, what a wonderful time that was. Unexpected words. Even though a bomb actually landed next to the, you know, those terraced houses they have in UK, just, you know, with one wall separating one house and another, even the next house where they were staying got a direct hit. And the windows shattered and my mother's arms was torn, blood streaming down, but managed to survive. Their neighbours right next door were killed instantly. It was night after night of things like that. Oh, what a wonderful time. How can you say that? Because everybody had to work together. There were very few arguments, and there's a great sense of togetherness in times of crisis. It's sad we have to have a crisis to learn the lessons of harmony. We can learn it when there's not such a crisis, how important it is to work together. Going back to some of the stories with my own mother, you know, when I do leave and you don't see me on a Friday evening or I'm overseas, sometimes I do go and visit family because I'm mostly in England. I remember visiting my family once. I was staying in my mother's house, and I don't just stay there. I usually, you know, offer to give talks here, there, and everywhere to make myself useful. And so I was giving a talk in a very nearby Sri Lankan temple, only about an hour's walk from where my mother lived. And I was due to give a talk there, and instead of getting people to pick me up and just going in a car, you know, I need the exercise, as you can all see. So I said, I'm going to walk there. So she was on one of these apartment buildings, which is owned by the local government. Now, these high rises, I think what's called these days, sink estates. It was supposed to be like a poor person's area. But when I went in the elevator on the 14th floor and went down to the ground floor, I think I was going to go and walk to this talk at a Sri Lankan temple where many people were going to come. As the doors opened on the ground floor, I was faced with a woman, an elderly woman, who was covered in blood. and it was apparently she had fallen down the stairs going to the basement, and she was obviously very badly injured but could still stand. So, of course, I forgot about my talk. I was going to talk on compassion anyway, so let's do some compassion. So I got her into the lift, made sure that, you know, she was reasonably okay, and took her back up to where my mother had her flat, and took her inside and called for the ambulance, while my mother and I just, with a cloth, tried to clean her up. But the most wonderful thing was that because we'd forgotten to close the door in the emergency, there was a trail of blood leading, you know, in the lift through the passageways to my mother's apartment. And one after one after one, people followed that trail of blood to see if they could help. And after a few minutes, there was a whole heap of people in my mother's room and trying to do what they could. There was a community. And it was wonderful to see that. A community had formed because somebody, you know, in this apartment block had had an injury and they could see it. And somebody went off to turn off the gas because she was cooking some dinner. Someone rang her relations. We arranged for the ambulance. She'd actually broken her leg and injured herself quite badly. But certainly from that time on, my mother said she really respected Buddhism and was always asking how I was and when I was going to come back. Simply because you were kind. But what impressed me was just how people would actually come together and help and stop whatever they were doing. There was a community formed. When we form communities, when we really respect and value one another and care for one another, where we have that harmony, it's amazing what people can achieve. I know one of the problems in our modern society is, and again, mental health problems. You know, most of those mental health problems arise because of isolation. And sometimes that isolation is self-imposed. Sometimes we don't allow other people to come close because we don't realize the importance of that harmony. We don't value ourselves and we don't value others. So I think it's very important in all human beings, no matter who they are, to see value in them. When you see value in them, this creates that relationship and creates the harmony. I often say, just how many times as a young monk here in Australia, I used to go and visit the jails. And my trick, if you like, to be successful sort of visiting jails was to see value in these people who'd done terrible crimes. Because if I could see value in people who had killed, who had raped, who had, you know, stolen and cheated, if I could see value in those people, it's very easy to see value in each one of you. And you can see value in anybody. And when you've seen value in somebody, that's what you look for. And that's what you see. That's what they show you back. If you look for the faults in someone else, the things which they've done wrong, they will show that back to you, for sure. But when you see something worthwhile, valuable, lovable, respectable in another human being, they show that back to you. That's one of the great secrets of creating harmony. So when I hang out with the Catholics or with the Anglicans or with the Jews or with the Muslims, you know, the reason we had a Muslim person come to give a talk here during our rains retreat, because I went to a conference with him in Phnom Penh. Actually, we went together to those killing fields, which I was talking about earlier. Because I valued him and he could value me, we could actually invite him, he could accept to come and give a talk here. I think it's a wonderful thing that we do such things because we're not just teaching philosophy. You're not going and thinking, you know, I'm a Buddhist, I'm a meditator, you can recite the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, dependent origination in Pali and Sanskrit and anything else. That's okay if you want to sort of get a degree in a university. But this is about real life and how we can do something to create a better world. And my point here is that what works to create a better world, you know, big time, is exactly the same thing which creates a better world in your family and also in your own meditation, in your own life, in your mind. Just the same way that I went to prisons and saw things I could value, and they showed that back to me, and we had beautiful relationships together. So even when I meditate, when I'm alone, when I'm travelling in an aircraft going somewhere or waiting in an airport, I can see something in myself that I value and care for. And that makes me in harmony with myself. When I see something inside of me which I value and care for, that actually grows and you become a more valuable, caring person. Now, of course, each one of us makes mistakes. Each one of us does stupid things. Yesterday I made a big mistake. I was at sort of a dana. This is where you invite the monks, you feed them, we give a little bit of a talk afterwards. I was giving a talk to the couple who invited me, and I knew they were married and they just had a child. They moved into a new house, and I was talking to them about, hopefully you're going to be very happy in this house, and together as a family you can look after one another and value each other. But there's another couple who were there also, a young man and young woman, sitting right next to each other. And they said, are you married as well? And he actually said yes, which was actually true, I suppose, logically. But they were married, but they just separated. So then I was going talking to them about how you can live happily together and peacefully together. I really blew it. So I don't think she's going to come here for a long time. I made a big mistake, but sometimes we do make mistakes. I just laugh at them sometimes. I remember some of the other big mistakes I made. I was giving a funeral service once. That's another thing you do, marriages, funerals, you name it, we do it. Give us a meal and we do anything. Not quite, but there we go. I was doing a funeral service once for somebody, and I said how sad it was, because I knew the children, because they used to come here very regularly. And I said, it's such a shame that your mother has passed away, and she was such a good woman. And then this old lady stood up at the back and said, it's not me who's dead, it's my husband. It's their father, stupid. So when you're doing a ceremony, you're trying to be solemn. Sometimes these things, I remember one of the other stupid things I said. It was some years ago, and yeah, just doing the stupid stuff now. In the community hall, before this hall was built, I did a marriage service in there. And this young Thai girl came in with this elderly Australian. And straight away, being stupid, I thought, oh, you must be the father-in-law. He said, no, I'm the groom. So that wedding didn't go off very well. So you make these mistakes, but you sort of laugh at them instead of getting upset at them. But you just don't worry about the mistakes of life. I always sometimes call them that, liken them to the simile of a sunset. Unless there's some imperfection on the horizon, you don't get beautiful sunsets. You need a few clouds or a bit of dust. And then if you look over the Indian Ocean in the evening time, you get these amazing sunsets, but only if there's some clouds or a bit of dust there. If it's perfect blue sky, you just see the sun go down, and it's not that nice. Not as nice as when there's a few imperfections. So imperfections in life actually give it texture, give it beauty. So we're not afraid of imperfections or differences or things which are wrong. But for harmony, we can accept those. There's sometimes a texture of life which makes life interesting and unique. But also we remember the things which bind us together, which join us together. It may be the case that men are from Mars and women are from Venus, but we all orbit around the same sun. We have a lot in common, much more than anybody thinks. You may sort of think that different races have different sort of tendencies. But it was wonderful that Japan had people from all races, even Africans. One of the interesting people at this Japanese conference, there was a couple of kings there. And one was the king of the Toro kingdom in Uganda. And the way he spoke, I'm not confirmed this yet, but it looks like he's a Buddhist. An Afro-Buddhist king. And that's really interesting. I don't know about the protocol. We should invite him to give a talk here. Really interesting. But it's amazing to see, you know, people from all different races coming together and all sorts of different types of Buddhism coming together, because we have something in common, and we can extend that to all people of different religions or no religions, to find the common ground, which is huge. When we keep focusing on the differences, then we will have wars. So the common ground with your neighbours, with the people in the office, with the enemy in the office, you can't stand. If you keep focusing on that, you'll have a terrible time at work. Why not see if you can see something you value in that enemy, in the person you hate? Seeing something of value is the start of compassion. I know Buddhists were supposed to be compassionate, be kind, but a common complaint is, how can you be compassionate? You know, it's all right for you, Ajahn Brahm. You live in a monastery with nice monks. You know, but you don't know what it's like out there in the real world. And of course you know what it's like. You should, you know, sometimes the monks you see, they're very well behaved up here. Actually, they are well behaved in the monastery as well. But sometimes, not always. So you always have some problems wherever you go in the world, but you know how to deal with those in a really good way. And respecting other people, finding something in there you value, is a start of compassion. Without that, you just can't even begin. Why should I be compassionate to that person? Why should I forgive them? If you see something to value in them, something worthwhile, then there is a good reason to be kind. Once we can do that, compassion and kindness is easy. And it's hugely beneficial. When you see something you respect in another person, and you have that inside you, not playing, you see something you respect, you can be kind. And that kindness will change that person. As it changes you, how many times have you been mistreated, abused, criticized, and you've deserved it? Oh, I deserve it, if you're really honest. But has it really helped? Hasn't really. But instead of actually being criticized and abused and told off when you've done something wrong, even if you deserved it, what's it like when someone actually understands you? Understands, yeah, you have made a mistake, but you're in difficult situations. You weren't perfect. You did do something wrong, as we all do. And they've understood you. If you've been understood when you made a mistake, it's one of the most wonderful experiences. People have actually really empathized with you. You know what it's like to be a human being. You have to make decisions, and sometimes you make wrong decisions, stupid decisions. But if you're criticized, you just hide those faults and you never learn from them. You get defensive. And you keep making the same mistakes over and over and over. But when people understand you with kindness, because they value you, you're a human being. You're a person just like me. When they value you and you make a mistake, they understand you. Then you can accept that mistake. You can see it, because you know that's not the whole of you. There's some other part which other people can see. I always tell people who have an enemy, there's many people, not just one, 10, 20, 30 people who love that person. Sometimes it's hard to imagine, how can anybody like that bastard? And you find that people actually love them. They've seen something in that person which you're blind to. How come someone can love you? Sometimes it's a great shock sometimes when a person says how much they love you. Me? You must be wrong. It's bad. If they can do that, why can't you love yourself? And have that same sense of esteem, value, same sense of self-worth. All it means is you can see the positive side of you, and that side will then grow. If you see the positive side of other people, that side of them will grow, and the negativity will disappear. You see the positive side of other religions, faiths, other philosophies, then that positive side will grow. This is the way we create harmony and peace in this world. It does work in big situations. I remember a conversation I will never forget. A young monk in Thailand, I was, and we had a former Prime Minister of Thailand who came to visit Ajahn Chah, and I happened to speak with him for a short while. And for those of you Thais, it was the Dr. Sanya Thammasat. He later became the King's chief advisor. He was a Prime Minister for about 1 year in Thailand, and he told me that he'd been in this important position. He said, there was never, ever a problem I couldn't solve with my enemies, with other politicians. Never was there a problem I couldn't solve. When I just went to see them, just the two of us, he said, I put my hand on his knee, which in Thailand didn't mean you were gay. It meant you were friends. And I put my hand on his knee as an act of friendship. And because I made friendship the first part of our conversation, we could always solve our differences. And he meant that. He was sincere. And when a person is such an important and a position where there's often so much conflict, as a prime minister, a leader of a nation, involved in all the politicking and vested interests, when he could say things like that, I thought, well, why can't I say things like that when I'm not a prime minister, just an abbot or just a leader? Surely I can do things like that too. And so you strive to do such things. And the trick is by valuing, seeing something of worth in another, and seeing that of worth in yourself, and seeing some worth in life. If you don't see any worth in life, you tend to get into addictive substances or even commit suicide. When you think, what's this life? It's a waste of time. You get born, you get old, you lose your job, you die. You get married, then you get divorced, lose all your money. You have kids, and they leave home. What's the point? It's very easy to get into negativity because you don't see value in things. So we deliberately see the value in this life. In Buddhism, we call this a precious human life. It's a life to learn things. Especially just it's one of the best universities where we can learn from disappointments. We know we're not in control of life. We try our very best and it goes wrong. We turn up for the airport and the plane is cancelled. It's life. Sometimes aircrafts, as I say, that plane which came from Singapore, the Qantas flight, which went up and down, as I said, I think, what do you expect, Qantas? It's called flying kangaroo. It's what kangaroos do, they go up and go down. So what's a big deal? So when you understand just about life, you learn a lot. And when you learn about, the more you learn, actually, the more that life doesn't hurt you anymore. And that's the meaning of life, is learning. And as we grow more and more, we find it's those difficult experiences of life, the ones which are painful, what I call the growing pains. So even that which is difficult to accept or to bear, as a monk, I realize that is the most important part of your life. At the time when you're experiencing that, that's hell. So difficult and so painful, and sometimes you wonder whether you could ever get out of that mess. But you do. Everyone does. But the payoff is what you learn. Painful at the time, but you grow so much. You learn so much. You know, the young people who come here, when young kids come here, you know, the 18, 19, 20-year-olds, they're always worried about, well, they usually come and speak to me usually when they've had breakups with their boyfriend or their girlfriend, the end of the world for them. And tell them, look, you don't know what love means until you've had your heart broken a few times. And they accept that and understand that it's true. And you have to have a bit of pain in order to understand the importance of compassion and kindness. And you've had a bit of difficulty in your life. Those are the sorts of people who get very, very compassionate and very kind and wise. was one of those reflections I had, seeing all these great meditators I knew in Thailand. And I couldn't really figure out why it was that some of those meditators, they can get very, very peaceful, very still, but they weren't wise. They couldn't really help other people. They couldn't give good talks or counsel others. While other people, they could meditate and they could share, they could counsel, they could teach. And when I investigated why that was, mostly it was those people, those monks, nuns, whatever, who had a lot of suffering in their life and became good meditators. They were the great teachers because they knew what it was like to be in pain. They knew what suffering was from personal experience. And of course, from the time of the Buddha, one of the greatest, if not one of the greatest teachers in the time of the Buddha was a woman, a nun. And I discovered this, you know, early on reading all these scriptures, you know, because I thought I'm a Buddhist, I should actually know what I'm supposed to be. So reading all these original ancient teachings of the Buddha. And I started reading the Theragata. This is the verses of the enlightened women in the time of the Buddha. It's a great read. And I had all these nuns who become enlightened. And there's a whole passage where the nun was saying that I'd been meditating for years, listening to talks and getting nowhere. And then this one nun came along, this great teacher. A week or 2 weeks, she was fully enlightened. And I read the next story, and the same thing happened. This one nun came along, and a few weeks later, all fully enlightened. I don't know how many nuns became enlightened because of this great teacher. And that great teacher was called Patachara. And her story was, you know, she came from a good family. She fell in love with someone of a lower caste, and the parents would not allow her to get married to the person she loved, so she ran away. She ran away with this guy. He's a very good guy. And so they ran away and lived in the forest. And when she became pregnant with her first child, it was a custom in India to go and see your parents. And she also knew, as I tell people these days, once you have a child, your grandparents will love you. Because sometimes if they don't approve of your husband or your wife, once you have a grandchild, then all your grandparents, they just want to have, all your parents want to have a part of your child. So it actually unites. So she went back to see her parents, but I think that actually she was going to give birth at her parents' house, but she gave birth on the way. So she went back home. And attempting the second time, she wanted to give birth at her parents' home for a second child. But again, she gave birth halfway. On this second time, after giving birth in the forest, her husband was trying to get some wood together to warm her. And in the wood was a snake, and he got bitten, and he died. And so poor Patachara had her husband dead. And in India in that time, that was no social security. It was very, very difficult to survive. So she had only one choice, to go to her parents. So she took her children, maybe a 1 or 2 year old, and the new baby. And unfortunately, that day there had been a big storm. And so the river was swollen, and she couldn't get both children across, carrying them. So she decided to carry the baby across first of all. She carried the baby across and put it down on the far bank, and then waded back to get her older son, the 2 year old. And halfway across, a big eagle swooped down to take her baby. And being too far away, she screamed and waved her arms to try and scare the bird away. And her older son thought that the waving and the screaming was asking him to come. So he waded into the waters. At the same time, the eagle swooped away with her newborn baby. The elder son waded into the water and got swept away by the current. Sort of in the matter of a few hours, she had lost her husband and her 2 children. And if that wasn't enough, as she wandered closer to her parents' home, she asked about her parents, and was told the news that because of the storm which had swollen the river, a tree had fallen on their house and both were dead. Lost her parents, her 2 children, and her husband on the same day. which drove her literally out of her mind. And because of her madness, and the grief which was too much for anyone to bear, she was wandering, babbling, her clothes had fallen off, absolutely naked. Because of some good karma, she wandered in to the monastery where the Buddha was giving a talk. Just like now, if I was giving a talk and a naked woman walked in here, what would you do? You say, protect the monks! And so somebody actually tried to push her out, but the Buddha said, no, let her in. And you know, one of the monks gave her a robe to put around her. But because she had so much tragedy so quickly, so her mind was actually open. And the Buddha sort of gave her a small teaching. She became a nun, and she became fully enlightened. And she was one hell of a teacher. Because of the pain which she'd experienced, immense, intense pain, there's no reason why you shouldn't believe that story. She became such a powerful woman, a great teacher. One of the other women I really respect just comes out. I mentioned her before. I've lost contact with her. If anyone knows where she is. Her name was, years ago I remember this, because I met her in Fremantle Prison when it was still open, when I was visiting there. Dasha Simkova, her name is. Never forget her, because she told me her story. I'd just been visiting the guys in Fremantle Jail, and she was a social worker there. So I had a cup of tea with her afterwards, and she told me her story. She was Czechoslovakian when there was one country before they split up. It was in 1968, I think it was, when the Soviet tanks came into Prague, because the government at that time, led by Alexander Dubček, had started reforms from the Soviet communist system. He was a populist, and everybody was right behind him. It was called the Prague Spring, and the Soviet tanks rolled in to crush that movement for freedom. She was, I think, a 16-year-old, a young girl, who decided to stand on the streets to protest. That wouldn't be a big thing in Australia, but in 1968, in Eastern Europe, I was taking your life into your hands. And unfortunately, she was one of the ones who was arrested and put in jail for protesting for her country, for freedom. Put in jail for, I think, 20 years or more. There was no lawyers, no human rights group to help her. And she told me that in those Eastern European jails, you were regularly beaten for nothing. It was part of the system. But she said, while she was experiencing the loss of the best years of a woman's life, 16 to 36, spent in an East European jail, whenever she was being beaten, she vowed never to get angry, never to feel resentment against her torturers. And that was an amazing thing to even think you can do. But she said she did it. Because she said, if I gave in to anger or resentment or feelings of revenge, my torturers would have won and I would have lost. For 20 years she did that until she was released. You can imagine just what a powerful woman that was. And how it was one of the great women I've met in my life. So she told me also, when any of the prisoners in Fremantle complained about the conditions, she would come into my office and I'd tell you what a real prison is like. And the prison would go, oh, Fremantle jail is wonderful. People couldn't do things like that. She was free from the torture. I'm not going to allow that to destroy my mind, to destroy my sense of integrity. And people like that, when you see people like that, you notice that pain and that strength which came from that pain made them amazing people. So when there are difficulties in your life, embrace them. Value them as well. because they're part of things too, and you become stronger, wiser, more compassionate as a result. In that way, that we can be in harmony, even with the darker side of our life, even in the painful part of our life. We can become in harmony with it as we accept it, embrace it, and make use of it, let alone the beautiful part of our life. When we're in harmony, not with life as it should be, but life as it actually is, then of course we know the secret to peace of mind. You will never be able to change the world. But you're always able to change yourself. You can't control others, but certainly you can control the way you relate to others and the way you relate to life. It is a path of harmony. It can be done. It is being done, and you can do that too. It's also a path of hope and a path of freedom. Whatever happens in this world, you can be free. All about harmony. And we try our very best, not just to talk like this, but to practice it. So, may you all live in peace and harmony.
Arahan Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivade Suakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammanamasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Sāvaka Saṅgho Saṅkhaṃ Namāmi.